Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, first of all, for having me. I have to confess to you, I don't actually get to preach at churches other than our own very often. So this is a little bit of like one of those, like, I don't really know exactly what to do. But as I came in this morning and was just checking in with Jordan, first of all, I thought Jordan was a guy when Shiju told me, like, you got to check in with Jordan. And so I came in and there's this chick with cowboy boots and I was like, that was not what I was expecting. But then she told me that you guys show up at least 15 minutes after everything starts. And I was like, I'm right at home. This is exactly how our church functions. So it is good to be with you guys, another Soma church, and a super huge pleasure and honor for me just to be able to bring you God's word this morning. Before I do so, I just want to share a bit of a greeting from West Village Church, and just to not just greet you, but also a little bit of just a note of thanks. As part of this larger Soma family of churches, we have been well aware that this season has been one that has been costly for your church family. I know just maybe like, what, a month and a half ago, you saw two families that have been really core to you guys step out of this context to move to Texas to kind of serve the larger Soma family. I know that for the past, you know, couple years, you guys have been giving of your time, your resources to serve the greater Soma family, and it has probably been at times discouraging and frustrating, and we have seen that from afar, and we just want to commission you and let you know that we are so thankful for your sacrifice. It has meant a lot to us, even though we probably don't get to cross-pollinate a ton at this level, and just know that I think Jesus has seen what you guys have sacrificed, and that it is being used for the kingdom as Paul and his family and the PEX as they're being used to continue to support our larger network of churches. So thank you so much on behalf of West Village, on behalf of our elders, for just the sacrifice of your time, treasures, and talents that you guys have given in the last season. Really quick, just a couple of fun facts about Victoria. Victoria is the capital city of our province. We don't have states, we have provinces. And it is the second least church city in the English-speaking part of Canada, which is most of Canada. And so we're in a context very similar to the Pacific Northwest, where you're going to experience like a lot of people who are either antagonistic or ambivalent to faith. So hopefully, as I share this morning, there will be some just some senses that, you know, our context and your context are very similar as I speak to those things. Now, Shiju told me that we are preaching through the book of Psalms this summer. That's true. You guys are going through Psalms as well. And our churches as well. And he told me that the focus has really been about this idea of discovering rest in God. And as I was starting to think about this and preparing, I wanted to ask the question, why is this important? Why is it important for us to be thinking about rest as, you know, Christians, as followers of Jesus, either in Issaquah or whatever kind of suburb of Issaquah that you're part of? I don't know if I said that right, but whatever little place that you find yourself here in the Pacific Northwest, why is it important to find rest? And there's lots of things we could say. I know that there's like a big kind of tech sector here. It's probably like a fast-paced living, lots of competition, lots of busyness, so easy to get your family immersed in every good thing. But I actually think there's something even more important than that. I believe that Soma Eastside is similar to West Village in that we are what I would call an activistic church. Now, I don't mean that you're going around and having protests and taking knees and all that stuff. What I mean is that we're constantly pounding the drum of mission. At West Village, we're constantly trying to remind everyone that you're a mission, that wherever you live, learn, work, and play, you're called to be a missionary. Does that language sound familiar for you guys? Yeah, so you guys hear this a lot, like go out, be a missionary, meet your neighbors, share Jesus, figure out how to let the gospel permeate all of life. And these are good and true things, but one of the dangers that can arise in this is that there's some subtle bits of idolatry that can creep in when you pound the drum of mission all the time. Now, I don't want you to hear something that I'm not saying. I'm not saying don't be on mission. I'm not saying don't like pour your life out for the sake of Jesus so that your friends and your neighbors and your coworkers and your classmates can come and experience Jesus. But what I do want to caution us is to say that when we talk about this a lot, something that can happen is that we start to not just serve and participate in mission out of like the overflow of the work that Jesus has done in us, sometimes we start to build into these things with expectation. And those expectations can easily become idols. So what happens when you're faithfully sharing Jesus with your neighbors and they just don't respond? What happens when you open your house sacrificially and people just take advantage of you? What happens when you are giving of yourself, doing all the things that a SOMA church would tell you to do, and you've been doing it for a long time and you still don't see that fruit that you expect? I think for some of us, we can get frustrated, disillusioned, and we can be like, why was I doing this in the first place? See, rest is really important because it's this subtle reminder, this Sabbath that we take out to remind ourselves first and foremost that we don't do because of what we will get. We do because of what we've already gotten, what we've already received. And rest is this place that we have to stop to remind ourselves that it is actually about Jesus. Secondly, I think even within that vein, we can get so consumed with being busy that we start to believe it depends on us. Have you been there before? Like, you really just start to think like, man, I am not doing a good enough job. I got to work harder, try more, and then we'll start to see this fruit get produced. It's no accident that God commanded the people of Israel to Sabbath, to rest. It was this way, this rhythm, if you will, this act of worship in which they had to actually stop for a moment and be reminded that God is the one who does the work. It is actually God who is in control. And so as we dive into our text this morning, I want you to keep this in mind, that this is actually an essential rhythm for a missional church. We need to be a people who learns to rest in all circumstances because it is an important reminder for us that it is God who is doing the work and it is God who has done the work, and we respond to that. So the text that we find ourselves in today, Psalm 31, is not one in which you would typically, I think of as a psalm talking about rest. It's really a psalm that David has written in the midst of a great of adversity. He's come under a bit of an attack. And so the question that I want to address this morning in our message is, how do you rest in the midst of adversity and attack? How do you actually enter into this Sabbath when life is chaos around you and people are coming up against you? I think this is, again, particularly important for us as people who are called to be on mission to this area. Again, if the Pacific Northwest is anything like Victoria, you're probably dealing with some antagonism, some people who look at what you believe and what you think and think you're probably a little bit backwards, and oftentimes might even see you as a threat to the things that they think are good. Earlier this week, I heard about a camp that I had grown up going to, a Christian camp, a huge heart for the community, a huge heart for people to come know Jesus. It's been around for like 50 years, and they had recently come under some controversy. You see, probably about 60% of the kids who go there are not from churched families. They're very like intentional about having spaces for the kids to be loved, cared for, and hear the gospel. And they're very intentional about making sure that the people that they bring on staff are fully committed to Jesus, which, again, probably most of us would say, yeah, that kind of makes sense. You're a Christian camp. You probably want Christians leading your camp. It turns out one of the parents found out that as their kid was aging up, that their kid would not necessarily be able to work at the camp because the camp had a pretty typical orthodox kind of sexual ethic, that the code of ethics that anyone who worked there had to sign off on. Pretty basic stuff if you've grown up in the church. And this parent was furious about it. And he said, like, I can't believe that, you know, my child can't work with other kids if they don't sign off on these things. And so he went and he wrote in the local newspaper, which was a newspaper that is already unfavorable to probably things like churches and Christians, And that newspaper blew up, and then two school districts in the area who had utilized the camp for years and years and years as a place for retreats and adventures, they suddenly said, we got to cut ties. Like, this goes against all of our policies for inclusion and diversity and all of these things. And they just started to attack and get hate mail and criticize this camp, all simply because the camp was seeking to be a faithful witness to Jesus and asking the people who were coming alongside them in partnership to do so. Now, I tell you this story not to boil your blood, because maybe some of you have experienced this, but just to be reminded that as you go out on mission, as you faithfully follow Jesus, it is inevitable that there will come a moment where you are going to clash with the world around you. You are going to come under a point where you are going to experience adversity and attack. So how do you rest in the midst of that? If you have your Bibles, open it up to Psalm 31. I'm going to be reading from the New International Version today. And I'm just going to jump in here, and we're going to see what David has to say about this. He begins in Psalm 31, verse 1, by saying, "In you, Lord, I have taken refuge. Let me never be put to shame. Deliver me in your righteousness. Turn your ear to me. Come quickly to my rescue. Be my rock of refuge, a strong fortress to save me. Since you are my rock and my fortress, for the sake of your name, lead and guide me. Keep me free from the trap that is set for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hands I commit my spirit. Deliver me, Lord, my faithful God." I want to stop here for a second just to help us understand a little bit what's going on. Psalm 31 doesn't give us any particular moment in David's life to root itself in. But it is clear right from the very beginning that David is dealing with some form of adversity. He talks about a trap being set for him. He calls on God never to allow him to be put to shame, to come quickly to his refuge, to save him. It is clear that David is in some form of attack. Just to help us understand some of the language he's using, I want to talk about that word shame. For us, when we think about shame, oftentimes I think we kind of psychologize it or make it kind of a therapeutic term. It's this internal thing that we think about that's happening. I feel bad about myself in some way. But when the Bible is using the term shame, it's actually more of a societal, a social term. It's actually talking about the way that the society has then turned upon this person and derided them. Probably a more easy term for us to catch on to would be canceled. David is essentially saying, I don't want to get canceled, God. I don't want to be this person who everyone walks away from, who is criticized, who is just completely blistered by the people around him as they critique him. Like, God, I don't want to come under this place where everyone looks down on me, where I am completely seen as anathema. But then he says this very interesting thing. He says, let me never be put to shame. And that confused me, because it seems to me like what he is saying as we continue to read through the psalm is that this is exactly what's happening to him. He has been shamed by his circumstances, shamed by his friends, shamed by his enemies, shamed by his cultural surroundings. So as I was researching this, I read a passage by a scholar named Gerald Wilson, and he says this, and I think it's helpful for us. He says, to seek never to be put to shame cannot mean complete escape from a lifetime or for a lifetime from any public reproach. What the psalmist desires then is not the avoidance of such shame, but an ultimate clearing of the slate and a public vindication of truth and righteousness. So as David begins, he's crying out to God. He uses words like refuge and rock and fortress. He's saying, God, I'm in the midst of this place where I'm being attacked, where I'm coming under adversity. And what does he do? He reaches out to God. He appeals to his character. And he calls on God to one day act to vindicate him before all of his enemies and all the things that he's experiencing. And as we see in verse 5, when he says, into your hands I commit my spirit, what David is doing is he's fully committing himself in trust to the character of Yahweh, despite what his current circumstances indicate. Now, is he doing this blindly? Is this a blind faith where he's just sort of shooting off an amorphous kind of call out to the universe, hoping that it turns his way? Well, no, because what we see next is that he is actually rooting it in his experience of God. He says in verse 6, I hate those who cling to worthless idols. As for me, I trust in the Lord. I will be glad and rejoice in your love, for you saw my affliction and knew the anguish of my soul. You have not given me into the hands of the enemy, but have set my feet in a spacious place. The first thing that David does is he actually says, I hate those who chase after worthless idols. When he uses that term worthless, the literal Hebrew phrase is like vain vanities, like completely unable to do anything. Like it's like chasing after the wind. Like it has no ability to satisfy you, no ability to rescue you. And David says, I hate those who cling to that. In contrast, though, he wants us to understand that what he clings to is not the wind, it's solid. I trust in the Lord. And he goes on to tell us that he'll rejoice in his love. Why? Because God has shown up for him. He's shown up for him in his anguish, in his affliction. He's rescued him from the hands of the enemy. Now, if you're familiar with the story of David, you know that this has happened time and time again in his lifetime. Again, we don't know exactly when he wrote this psalm, but what we do know is that David has a history of God showing up in his life. Showing up, rescuing him, being there for him, caring for his needs. And not only that, David's aware of the greater story of his people. How God had come and rescued the Israelites out of slavery to Egypt, bringing them straight through the Red Sea, away from the hand of Pharaoh and his armies, bringing them through the wilderness, bringing them into a land in which there was peoples who were greater and stronger and entrenched, and yet they were able to drive them out. So he has this history of God's faithful love, God's faithful power, and God's faithful rescue to draw from. And this is exactly what he is doing here. David looks back to the past and says, I can actually trust God in this moment because he has proven himself trustworthy in the past. So again, let me go back to the question we started with. How do you rest in God in the midst of adversity or in the midst of coming under attack? Well, the first thing I think David would point out to us is that you have to continue to look back to what God has already done. But then David moves into what I call his dark night of the soul. Maybe some of you can relate to this. It's this moment where your circumstances aren't just bad, they're blindingly bad, meaning that you cannot see an alternative. As you look out at the kind of the circumstance that you're in, all you can see is darkness. All you can see is brokenness. All you can see is the pain and the suffering and the sorrow. And this is the place that David finds himself in. He says in verse 9, be merciful to me, Lord, for I am in distress. My eyes grow weak with sorrow, my soul and my body with grief. My life is consumed by anguish and my years by groaning. My strength fails because of my affliction and my bones grow weak. Because of all my enemies, I am the utter contempt, hear that, I am the utter contempt of my neighbors and an object of dread to who? My closest friends. Those who see me on the street flee from me. I am forgotten as though I were dead. I've become like broken pottery, for I hear many whispering, terror on every side. They conspire against me and they plot to take my life. So David has this moment where he's calling out to God and he's rooting that call in God's faithfulness in the past, but then things get worse and he can't see God anymore. He can't see God's faithfulness anymore. His circumstances just block it out completely. And I mean, this pain that he describes in like such poetic form, like it's so real, isn't it? Like he literally describes physical symptoms of stress and strain. My eyes are growing weak. Like my soul and my body are racked with grief and sorrow. My bones grow weak. Like these are physical symptoms of stress and strain. I don't know if any of you have ever been to that point where you have You have felt so isolated, so alone, or under such a weight or pressure, or felt so attacked that your body literally starts to shut down. There's a Canadian psychologist who's kind of become popular in the last few years. You might have heard of him before. His name is Jordan Peterson. I'm not advocating Jordan Peterson, but I do find it interesting to listen to his experience. He came to popularity because he started to critique some of the government's policies when it came to language. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty hot button issue. And so he came under essentially a ton of attack. And why I bring him up is because he actually had a very physical reaction as he was essentially being canceled and critiqued and coming under attack. Like, his body started to shut down, so much so that he almost died and he had to completely change his diet. Like, this is a real thing. Like, when we come under this place of attack, our bodies are going to viscerally feel it. This does not sound restful to me. So how do we rest if this is what could happen to us? And yet, I also want to point out another moment of physical stress and strain. Some of you may remember in the Passion account, Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. Do you remember what happens? Sweats blood. What's happening? He is coming under so much stress and so much strain that Jesus has a very physical response. And this all comes from this deep sense of emotional turmoil. The whole second half of this section, from verse 9 to verse 14 or 13, that's what he's talking about. David says, like, because of all my enemies, I am the utter contempt of my neighbors. So I don't just feel like I'm coming under attack from the people who are against me, but now the people who are close to me, my friends, the people who are supposed to be my allies, my support system, all of that has been stripped away, and I am completely and utterly alone. God, where are you? And that's really all he can do. All he does to begin with is just lob out like a desperate call to God, be merciful to me, Lord, for I am in distress. You, as you continue to faithfully follow Jesus in his mission, may come to a point where you start to experience such a strong form of attack where you might even feel like this sense again of that shame, that being canceled, where people you thought were your friends were like, I'm not going to touch you. Or maybe even people in your support structure have like left you because they don't want to get pulled into whatever's going on. As you faithfully follow Jesus and his mission, there are going to be times when you experience adversity. How do you find rest in those moments? As David cries out to God, despite what his circumstances dictate, he makes a turn. In verse 14, he says this, "But I trust in you. I trust in you, Lord. I say you are my God." Do you hear that switch? Like, not like so personal, like so animate, right? In that moment of deepest darkness, what does he do? He reaches out to the only lifeline that he has, to God. "My times are in your hands. Deliver me from the hands of my enemies, from those who pursue me. Let your face shine on your servant. Save me with your unfailing love." That's that, like, chesed, that covenantal love, like, based on your character, based on who you are, Father, based on the promises that you've made, the love that you have declared for me, Father, save me. And he repeats that term, "Let me not be put to shame, Lord, for I have cried out to you. But let the wicked be put to shame and be silent in the realm of the dead. Let their lying lips be silenced, for with pride and contempt they speak arrogantly against the righteous." in the midst of his most dark and dismal moment, when the reality in front of him makes it look like God is absent, what does David do? He doubles down. He actually puts his faith in God's character. He says, "You have given me your unfailing love. I'm going to actually trust that in this moment." So how is David finding rest in the midst of these circumstances? One, we see that he looks back into the past, God's faithfulness, to give him hope for the present. And two, he looks at God's character, and he puts his faith in God to be faithful to what he has said he is and who he has said he is. The final thing that David appeals to, we see in verse 19. He says, "How abundant are the good things that you have stored up for those who fear you, that you bestow in the sight of all on those who take refuge in you. In the shelter of your presence you hide them. From all human intrigues you keep them safe in your dwelling from accusing tongues." So David moves on from, hey, Jesus, I'm going to trust your God. I'm going to trust you. And then he starts to appeal to not only how God's character is giving him hope in the present, but how God's promises actually give him hope for the future. He's actually choosing to believe in this moment that his circumstances aren't reality, that reality is what God has promised him. And that reality is not something that the enemies who are coming against him in this moment can take from him. "How abundant are the good things that you have stored up for those who fear you, that you bestow on the sight of all on those who take refuge in you. In the shelter of your presence, you hide them from all human intrigues." There is no human being who can change the things that you have set into place, God. So I can trust not just in your past work. I can trust not just in your character, but I can trust in your future promises that what is happening for me is not the final word. That what you are doing cannot be undone by the people who are coming against me now. So as we look at this, we see three things that David appeals to, three means by which he finds rest in the midst of horrific, like viscerally, like disturbing circumstances. As he experiences this, one, he looks back into God's faithfulness. Two, he looks at God's character. And three, he looks to God's future promises. Now, this is great, right? Like, let's go home. Let's do this. Let's continue to look at God's faithfulness in the past. Let's continue to appeal to his character. Let's continue to look on hope to the future things that he has promised. Here's a problem. This psalm is not about you, and it's not about me. You see, David doesn't represent us. David is a foreshadow of Christ. There are some general assumptions that the psalmist makes, as we'll see. He talks about the people being righteous, that God is rescuing his righteous one. Well, that's not me. If our calling is to fully put our faith in God's past work, can we just be honest and say, yeah, we don't do that very often? At least I don't. I forget so often. I forget that God has been faithful even in the little things, let alone like my salvation. A few years ago, Shannon and I were blessed to be able to buy a house, and it was like essentially gifted to us. Like not gifted, but like it was given to us in such a way that it was like so accessible for us to be able to get. And it was so clear that God had opened up this opportunity. And yet for so long after that, even though he had shown us this incredible amount of care and generosity, man, I stress about money all the time. Like he literally provided a house in the third most expensive city in Canada where we did not have like the income to be able to afford a house. And yet I was worried about money. Like if I'm going to try and find rest by looking at the past, I just have to be honest and say, I forget all the time how good Jesus is, all the ways that he's provided for me, all his sufficiency. And so what do I do instead? And I chase after other things. Vain vanities, idols. I look to things to do what only God can do. I forget God's character. And then I start trusting in other things. I think I heard Paul once say, I'm going to move from preaching to meddling. Is that a familiar phrase? I'm going to move from preaching to meddling a little bit. When we talk about adversity, if your country is anything like ours, we want to like be active. We want to fight it. And so we can start to look to organizations or political parties or politicians, getting the right people in the right place. And don't hear me again saying something I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we should not be faithful to try and find like good people to like run the things that need to be run. But subtly we can start to actually put our faith in those things. Subtly we can start to think that that is the thing that matters. That's the thing that's going to change us. What's so interesting about this psalm is at no point do you hear David say, like, God, I'm going to pick myself up with my bootstraps. I'm going to fight back. I'm going to crush those enemies. I am going to do this. At every point, what does he do? I'm putting my trust in you. God, I need you. God, you're my fortress. God, you're the one in whom I rest. But I know for me, so often that's not the case. And then I look to try and control my circumstances. I think I need to, rather than trusting in God to produce the future that he has promised, I need to bring it into effect. I need to bring the change. And the fruit of that oftentimes is not rest, it's fear, it's anxiety, it's rage. There's a Princeton scholar by the name of Miroslav Volf. He wrote a book called Inclusion and Embrace. And he talks about the situation that happened. He's Croatian by descent, and he wrote Exclusion and Embrace in the midst of like the crisis in that area of the world, the Bosnia, Herzegovina, I can't even say it, the Serbs and the Croats and all these people like basically killing each other. And as he was doing this, he reflected on the ways that the people were communicating. So he said, you know, you go in the room with the people who are the aggressors in this conflict, and you start to try and unpeel for them, like, why are you doing this? And they are always justified because at some point the people that they were attacking had first attacked them. You see, when we start to put our faith in vain vanities, what does it produce? It produces fear, anger, rage, anxiety. And what does that produce in our actions? It's exactly what Miroslav Volf talks about. All these people who then justify the atrocities because they need to defend themselves. They need to get back theirs. They need to once more get into control. Now, we're hopefully not going around and killing each other, but maybe there are subtle ways that we are indeed trying to mount a counterattack. And yet that's not what David does here. At no point does he do that. He finds rest. And so if this is the calling for you and for me, I think we just have to admit we are completely and utterly missing the mark. But here's the beautiful reality. See, David is a Christ type. He is a foreshadow of Jesus. In fact, it's no accident Luke records verse 5, on Jesus' tongue, while he hangs on the cross, into your hands I commit my spirit. Is Jesus not the perfect representation of the heart of this psalm? The one who goes to the cross in full faith and understanding of the past work of God. The one who, even as he is in the garden and his circumstances look bleak around him, as his friends abandon him, as his culture crushes him, as he literally experiences canceling in the most horrific form, being blamed for something even though he is innocent, says to his father, despite my circumstances, despite what is happening to me, I am going to trust your character. You are the one who I can commit my spirit to whom I can give my life to. Is it not Jesus who in faith, in hope, in complete and utter obedience and submission to the Father, knowing that the Father has a future plan that he has promised, goes to his death, goes to the darkest night of the soul where he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And yet, in the midst of that anguish, trust that God will indeed take that dark moment and redeem it for his good and perfect purposes. And because Jesus has done what you and I cannot do, it actually changes everything. You see, when Jesus went to the cross, when he acted out in faith to God, when he did what we could not, he gave us something. He gave us a new identity. An identity that cannot be taken away by any circumstance, a reality that cannot be destroyed by any amount of pressure. You may come under attack. People might attack your values. They might attack your character. They might attack your position in life. If you're a parent and you choose to raise your kids in a particular way, they could criticize you, attack you. But when Jesus went to the cross, he gave you something that no one can take away because it's not based on you. If someone says, Andrew, you're a horrible father because you don't give in to every whim of your kid. Well, you know what? I have lots of moments where I'm a horrible father. It's true. But I have an identity that's not based on how good a father I am. It's based on how good a father I have. And so when someone attacks me and critiques me, I don't cling to myself. I cling to Jesus. I cling to the things that he says about me, the things that he has done for me. Even in this moment, as I share with you these ways that we cling to God in the past and the present and through his character and in the future, like even in those moments when I'm in this darkest place, I don't even have to cling to that. I just cling to Jesus because he's done that. And when we find ourselves throwing ourselves onto Jesus, crying out, as David did, for the mercy of Jesus to come and we cling to the things that he's done for us, then it actually does indeed provide a space of rest because it allows us to fully surrender, to commit our spirits to him. We have this new unearned identity that can't be shaken because it wasn't something that we did. And so we can trust in him because he has been faithful. He has been true. And he has demonstrated that even in the darkest, most horrific moment at the cross, where it looked like God himself had lost, where it looked like God himself was dead, that he was at work bringing all things together for the good. And so we can cling to that despite the darkness of our circumstances. And so we find rest as we cling to Jesus. when you come under attack, what do? You cling to Jesus. You don't need to push back. You don't need to figure it out for yourself. You need to rest in Jesus. I want to finish off the end of this psalm. I'm going to invite Hannah. You can come back here where we are. And as I finish off, I just want to share with you some of the fruit that then takes place in our life when we cling to Jesus. In verse 21, David says, "Praise be to the Lord, for he showed me the wonders of his love. When I was in the city under siege, in my alarm I said, 'I am cut off from your sight,' yet you heard my cry for mercy when I called you for help." So David just says basically, God, you showed up. Like, Jesus, we needed you. We couldn't have done this on our own. We needed you. And then he says this in verse 23, love the Lord, all his faithful people. The Lord preserves those who are true to him, but the proud he pays back in full. Be strong and take heart, all you who hope in the Lord. He uses three terms to talk about the people of God, the people who have experienced this. And I think they actually give us clues into three types of fruit that we'll see in our lives as we learn to rest in God. The first term he uses is what the NIV calls faithful people, but probably more accurately could be translated holy people or saints. When we rest in Jesus, one of the things that we're going to notice is that no matter what happens to us, our lives will be set apart holy lives. One of the things that can often happen when we come under adversity and attack is we get tempted to change our ways. It's too hard. We want to give it up. We want to compromise. And yet, when we find ourselves fully resting in Jesus, we can remain faithful in obedience to him as a holy people. The second term that he uses, he talks about those who are true to him. And this really brings about more of that connotation of faithfulness, that sense that as we rest, it's going to show an actual reality in our daily lives, this faithfulness, this regular entrusting of our lives in the good times and the bad times to Jesus. But what this looks like is a regular acknowledgement of our need for him. Some of us would think about like a daily habitual practice that just allows us to anchor ourselves in the perfect and finished work of Jesus. A sense that we regularly recognize our need for him through prayer, through reading his word, through, again, anchoring ourselves in what he's done. And then the third characteristic that David talks about is all those who hope in the Lord. And this is really about longevity, endurance. What David wants us to understand here is that rest is not just a temporary thing. It's something that gets worked out in a lifetime. It's a way in which we continue to entrust God through all the peaks and the valleys of our lives. You know, it's so easy to trust God in the good times, but it's also really easy to forget about God in the good times, to forget that we need him. And yet, what he's talking about here is a trust that as we look back at our lives will be demonstrated in an enduring sense that it's happened continually. I want to finish off. Sorry, Hannah, I brought you up maybe a little too early. I want to finish off here with one last thought. This has really been applied to ourselves as missionaries, but there is also a missional application for us here. It's no accident that in the book of 1 Peter, that Peter is writing to churches who are coming under strain, adversity, attack. And yet he says something very interesting. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12, he says this to the churches, "Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." When we learn to rest in Jesus, it's actually maybe one of the most missional things that we can do. In a world that can be so polarized, in a world that can be so filled with conflict and anger, when we as the people of God experience that and yet don't retaliate and yet put our faith and trust in Jesus, the world may accuse us of doing wrong, But what they're going to see is Jesus. And so maybe one of the best things that you can do when you come under adversity as a missionary is to throw yourself in trust into his arms. Because it's a message that a world that is so desperate to try and figure out control and power and fight back needs to see. I'm going to pray for us, and then we'll prepare for communion together. Father, I just want to thank you for Soma Eastside. Thank you for just their desire and faithfulness to be salt and light here on the east side of the greater Seattle area. I just pray for my brothers and sisters here that they would continue just the good work of being missionaries here in the city. But Father, as they come under moments of clash, of adversity, maybe in workplaces, maybe in schools, maybe among friends or neighbors, maybe even among family, as they stay faithful to you, that in these moments that they would be able to find rest as you are calling Shannon and I and West Village Church to find rest in you. And that in that rest that you might receive glory. And that a world who so desperately needs to be able to trust you and your goodness and your promises can see that put in display in this reality that transcends the immediate reality that they're experiencing. I pray this in your name. Amen. We're going to get a chance to respond together to this in a couple of different ways. We're going to take communion together. Communion is just this regular reminder that Jesus has done what we cannot. So we're going to take the bread, which represents his body broken for us, and we'll dip it into the wine or the grape juice. I think that's right. And that represents his blood shed for us, that he did what we cannot, and so we can rest in him. Another rhythm of rest is, again, just entrusting God with our finances, recognizing that all of it is in his control. And so there's an opportunity for you to just act out in worship by giving.